This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, you're listening to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Dafrin Johan. Recently, the Department of Statistics released the first ever Malaysia Happiness Index. The study revealed that the top five happiest states in the country include that of Labuan, Kuala Lumpur, Putrajaya, Terengganu and Kelantan. In response to that, the Kelantan Deputy Menteri Besar, Dato' Mohd Ammar Abdullah, said that, and I quote, "We are among the happy states. Happy means that the people are satisfied, the people are happy, even if there are problems," end quote. The Deputy MP also went on to say that this is proof that the past-led state is doing better than the likes of Selangor. So this is what I'm going to be exploring today, the tie between happiness and the well-being of citizens in a particular state. Joining me on the show today to discuss this is James Chai. He's a visiting fellow at the ICS Yusof Ishak Institute. Welcome to the show, James. What are your overall thoughts on what the Kelantan Deputy Menteri Besar said?
What was interesting about what he said was, other than pointing out that Kedah was in the top five in terms of the happiest state in Malaysia, it was also to draw this contrast. The only other state that he pointed out was Selangor. And I think the reason for that is because Selangor is the richest state in the country and constantly being used as an example of a state to emulate. And I think what he wanted to draw out was to show that even though Kelantan was the poorest state compared to the richest state of Selangor, we didn't. Kelantan doesn't want to aspire to be like Selangor, because Kelantan people are the happy ones. Selangor are the ones who are not. The fundamental purpose, I think, in drawing this contrast was to misuse the index to show that there are certain things that are going well, so that it distracts us from other developmental or like well-being related indexes of Kelantan. So I think he was, surprisingly enough, right, he was the only state chief administrator who actually pointed or used the happiness index to his benefit.
Right.
And I think, you know, to some extent, that's quite misleading, right? It's a classic case of like misusing statistics for your benefit.
Absolutely. Now, this is what's very interesting, because like you said, he drew comparisons to Selangor, and the 2022 Malaysia Happiness Index, it reveals a very interesting ranking, right? Because the top five states which rank happiest is Labuan, KL, Kuala Lumpur itself, not Selangor, Putrajaya, Terengganu and Kelantan. And the states that are ranked mediocrely happy include Selangor and Melaka. How do you make sense of this from a socio-political lens?
I think that to some extent, the index is a reflection of their methods, right? So to some extent, there are some emphasis on certain things over the other. I do think overall that this happiness index is a step in the right direction of trying to capture the things that the GDP index can't capture, right? So if you try to look at the rankings of all of the states, you would realize that what you pointed out, KL and Putrajaya are some of the wealthier states, right? So it makes sense to some extent that they are ranked highly because as you get richer in the state, you get to enjoy certain developmental benefits as well on a personal level. You get to purchase more things that could give you more leisurely time and therefore making you happier. The challenge is that why is other poorer state like Kelantan and Terengganu also quite closely ranked with KL and Putrajaya? So this is where it's very interesting, because if you look into the details of this happiness ranking, it points like religion and spirituality, how you feel about your family.
Right.
Those are mainly contributing to why Kelantan and Terengganu rank so high. Right. So there are other other pointers that the index try to capture, like your sense of safety, your education, your health, culture, income, and so on. And it is not surprising, I think, across Malaysia, a lot of Malaysians don't actually attribute much happiness from their income, whereas they attribute much more happiness from religion and spirituality. And this is the most pertinent reason as to why Kelantan and Terengganu gets pushed up so high.
Right. The thing about happiness, right, it's, you know, as a concept, it sometimes can feel very abstract. Like what is happiness, you know, in that sense? But like you said, there are certain aspects that they sort of measure, religion, spirituality, family, income, a lot of different aspects, right? I'm wondering just, you know, since we are on this topic, perhaps a little bit of a philosophical question. How would you define happiness, you know, and do the aspects that, you know, that they measure, does it tally, or, you know, is that the same way you measure happiness?
I think on the index front, they certainly try to be as holistic as possible. And I think they were definitely mirroring a lot of global happiness index methods of trying to capture that. The only thing that I'm not clear from the index would be the weightage they actually assign to each of it, right? Which is like, after, if I rank religion very highly and it has like high weightage in terms of how it is measured, then obviously my happiness ranking will be very, very high compared to income, right? So I'm not clear about that, which is like, it is true that to some extent, happiness comes from a more holistic lens that you have to consider whether you feel safe in your community, whether you have sufficient education to function well, whether there are certain income level that you have to strive for in order for you to feel like you have a balanced life and those kind of stuff, right? So I think to some extent that's correct, but how much importance I assign to each of it is also something that is quite interesting. But on a personal level, I think on a very simple way of understanding happiness, I really do think it boils down to the freedom for you to decide the way that you want to live your life, right? So fundamentally, it has a lot to do with your autonomy and your ability to decide. Because in order for you to get to that point, there are certain things that you have to sort of like have as basic requirements, right? Your income has to reach a certain level, right? A lot of people are talking about living wage, a dignified way of living. Mm-hmm. Those things has to be there in order for you to have a freedom. To some extent, society around you has to support and not, of course, be judgmental or like there are laws that are too prohibitive in society. At the same time, a lot of it, right? If you are a religious or spiritual person, to some extent, you need those avenues to pursue a purpose that are higher than just what you're seeing on a day-to-day, right? So you're pursuing something higher. But it all boils down to the same concept, right? Whether you have the ability and you are free to actually pursue the life that you want to live. I think that would give a lot of people a certain sense of peace and acceptance that this is a worthwhile life, and therefore I think that would make you happy.
You know, it's just circling back to Kelantan, right? The Kelantan's the Deputy Menteri Besar, he claimed that happiness index is a reflection of their work. I'm talking about the Kelantan past government's work. And this is also the part where you really zoom in on, it became the focus of your article on Malaysia Kini. Now, paint a picture for us, James. What is Kelantan's socioeconomic realities?
So where I started in my article was a very, very strange but overlooked statistic, right? That in 1991, all of the states in the country, for the male population, they live to 69 years old. The crazy thing about it is that 25 years later, with development, with better access to healthcare, with more income, with healthier food that Malaysians eat, Malaysian male generally could live to 72.7 years, right? So that's in 2016. But for Kelantan and Terengganu, surprisingly, their life expectancy stuck at 69. So what that means, right, is that, on a conceptual level, you think that, okay, 72.7 compared to 69 is only like 3 years, right? So they are deprived of those 3 years. But if you think about it on a different lens, which is after 25 years, everyone else has developed. And 25 years is normally one generation, right? Mm-hmm. They are left behind by one generation. So that's how you think about it, right? And the other stats really support this, right? We know that Kelantan has the highest concentration of poor households. Mm-hmm. They are the poorest in terms of income per capita. At the same time, there are many social ills like drug addiction that are very, very rampant in the state for a very long time, right? And if you look into further details, just like the very basic facilities to carry on with life, which is to have like clean pipe water at your house.
Right.
Apparently, 3 out of 10 people still don't have that, right? So they're really a generation or more behind. And that's the reality that, of course, the Kelantan MB would ignore. Because those, I don't think there is any way for you to contest that that is a bad condition. And I think to some extent, the past government also accepted that this is slow compared to other states. And they're even starting to justify that this slowness is to some extent deliberate. Right, wanting to keep the people poor so that, like what we were discussing earlier, that they get to a certain point of being so deprived that they no longer ask for more.
You quoted Nobel laureate Amartya Sen: "The people who live in great misfortune with little hope may get more happiness over the little things they have." Now, James, if that is the case, right, and it is a very intriguing quote, but I'm wondering if that's the case, then why aren't the poorer states the happiest?
What I think that quote was trying to understand is why are certain poor states so happy in terms of how they rank, right? Because the general rule shouldn't be that. The general rule, I think, has to do with like, the more developed and the higher income the country is, as well as the state is, you generally are happier, right? And the other trajectory is that the poorer you are, the less happy you are. However, like any other thing in life, there is probably some sort of inflection point. In other words, you could imagine this graph, right, being something like an inverted U. Or an N, right? Where initially your happiness index would be very low because you are poor. And as you get more richer and richer, your happiness goes up. But at the same time, there will be an inflection whereby sort of when you get too rich, you start to become envious, you start to care, for something that you can't strive for because you would never have enough. And that's why your happiness goes down again. Right. That kind of stuff, right? So generally, I think, like any other thing in life, there will be an inflection point whereby the logic changes. But I think what that quote and my article was trying to understand was that why are there certain very niche areas? So if you look at the global happiness index around the world, right? There will be countries like Norway, Denmark, the Scandinavian countries that are ranked very highly. And this is without surprise, right?
Right.
But there are also countries that you actually don't expect who are there. So places like El Salvador, Guatemala, if you look further down in terms of maybe the top 30 countries, right? Mm-hmm. And Kosovo, Trinidad and Tobago, which are very low income countries. But why are they also there, right? So I think the question really is, are there certain exceptions to these niche areas? And my focus was because Kelantan was the poorest state, and why are they feeling happy in that respect, right? So trying to sort of dissect certain niche areas would help us understand that it is not illogical for people who are super deprived to feel happy with certain small gains that they have.
Absolutely. And is that how you also make sense of the fact that, you know, on the one hand, you got Penang, one of the richest states in the country, very highly developed, constantly developing. And then on the other hand, you have Sabah, which we know that people, till today, kids have to row broken boats, makeshift boats, climb makeshift bridges just to get to school. It's very, very underdeveloped. But yet, Penang and Sabah scored roughly the same on the happiness index.
Yeah, I think that's the case, right? So like I mentioned just now, when the inverted U, right? Mm-hmm. If you think about it, the Sabah is a very poor state, one of the poorest states, right? But they are not the poorest if you compare it to Kelantan, right?
Yes,
So if you look at an inverted U, you try to draw a straight line, right? One part on the left would be where Sabah is, and on the right would be where Penang is. But even though Penang, being a very rich state, is definitely not the richest state, right? But so it is possible that to some extent that their happiness level is actually the same, even though they belong into two very different spectrums of the income level, right? But what was interesting is that generally this is understood, but why is Sabah not to the happiness level of Kelantan? Right, if they are quite both of them quite poor, why is Kelantan way happier than Sabah? I think that's where the religion and spirituality part comes in, which is like religion is much more embedded in the administration of Kelantan and Terengganu compared to Sabah, and that's why they got the additional push, I think, because if without religion and you put it out of the equation, the happiness level probably would be lower to the level of like Sabah.
On the show with me today is James Chai, visiting fellow at the ICS Yusof Ishak Institute. After the break, we discuss perceived inequality and inequity and its relationship with happiness. Keep it here on Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Dashan Johan, and on the show with me today is James Chai, visiting fellow at the ICS Yusof Ishak Institute, and we're making sense of the Malaysian Happiness Index and its relationship to citizens' well-being. So, James, I'm wondering if one of the reasons why, let's say, Kelantan ranks really high in terms of happiness, on top of, let's say, religion, is also a sort of community ties, you know, because a lot of people say, for example, when it comes to grassroots politics, mobilizing people, if they want to mobilize a community, they can much faster and in much bigger numbers, or, you know, or much swifter than, let's say, in urban circles and things like that. And if, in fact, when we talk to, let's say, people from Bersih themselves, to, or even when we look at the Abolish ISA move, they, even till today, they do give credit to PAS, or it was a different, slightly different PAS back then, but they said PAS's ability to really mobilize the community in big numbers. So I'm wondering if this sort of family ties, community ties and all also may shape Kelantan's happiness index.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case, because if other than religion and spirituality, the second highest issue that Kelantan voted on was actually their family. Right. So the family and the community is very interesting, because I think if you go to Kelantan, you would realize that they're quite communal in that respect, because I think many of them would intersect in terms of their beliefs in religion, right? As to like what the purpose of life is and how you should, the way of your daily life is also something that everyone can agree on as to what is the best way of living. So, for instance, if you put a very diverse group of people, how they actually perceive life and how they carry on their day-to-day life is actually very different from one another, right? So, there are a lot of studies in like huge metropolis. People actually feel very alone, even though they live much closer together, because they're quite different in terms of where they come from. And therefore, there's no template as to like what's the best way of living and what's the ultimate purpose, right? Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes in a place like Kelantan, the power of religion in providing a very substantial framework to live your life is something that we underestimate, because religion can be quite comprehensive in providing you answers to every aspect. And that's why I think Kelantanese generally among themselves, they don't disagree as to what's the best way of moving forward. And maybe to some extent, that also explains why PAS is so strong, because it's not only a political party, right? It's also a religious party, right, that is very embedded in their community. And mm-hmm. that's why I think that explains the level of stronghold that PAS has in Kelantan.
Absolutely. Do you think, James, the happiness index is a good tool to measure the well-being of citizens or how a particular place is performing socioeconomically?
I don't think so, because mm-hmm. I think a happiness index on its own is meant to be a supplementary tool right. to the other indexes that we take into account, right? So I think in the past, there was a lot of complaints, and rightfully so, that simply by measuring GDP is definitely mm-hmm. inadequate, right? Because you only measure things that are economically productive to society, and you ignore a lot of things like social work, home caring, or like any other forms of work that are typically carried out by women in the past, right? You consider that to be invisible, and it doesn't add into whether the country feels better or worse. So in the past, just simply relying on GDP matrix would definitely be very inadequate. So when it was suggested, I think maybe 10 years ago, that you need to start looking into happiness instead and then try to measure well-being, that would be a good supplementary tool, because it may not be enough that the GDP of a country is high. We want to make sure that the people also feel happier compared to much poorer countries. So on its own, if you take happiness index itself, it is very inadequate. There are a lot of things that it doesn't capture at all. Mm-hmm. But if you use it as a supplementary tool to larger picture, so that's why if you look at Kelantan, it's not enough for you to look at how happy they are. You need to also take into account whether there are certain sort of facilities and sort of like the basic necessities that are provided to them. And if you look at both of those things together, then you would realize that Kelantan isn't that great a state to be in.
Right.
Right. So that I think is quite important.
Now, do you think that the happiness index is a good reflection of inequality or inequity? So, for example, we look at Kelantan, and you know, people in Kelantan may not have clean water, they may not be doing too well socioeconomically. I mean, that's facts. Like, facts are facts. They say you cannot deny that. But perhaps I'm wondering, you know, when the Kelantanese, I'm wondering if the Kelantanese masses see themselves, at least as a perceived sort of notion, that they are on an equal playing field. Because I don't have clean water. I look left and right. My neighbors don't have clean water. My neighbor called her auntie. They don't have clean water. Everybody doesn't have clean water, for example. And then in contrast, in Selangor, you can look to your left, literally, right? Look to one direction and see people living in gated communities in 2 million ringgit houses and, you know, big houses, luxury condos and, you know, condos on top of shopping malls and things like that. And then you look to your right and you have people living in PPR flats, struggling to get by and things like that. The disparity is so huge. And I'm wondering if this disparity, where you look to your left, look to your right, and you know how much you don't have, you actively can see how much you don't have,
yeah,
contributes to that level of unhappiness.
Yeah, I think that's the main reason as to why Selangor is ranked the last. And if you talk about the numbers in terms of the happiness index, right, like you have like Labuan, I think, is a bit of an outlier. But if you look at KL, Putrajaya, and so on, right, mm-hmm. their happiness index is like 7 point something, right?
Yep.
But if you look at Selangor, it's 5.7, which no other state comes close to how unhappy they are, right? They're almost like 50-50, like half of the people are really unhappy, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the concept behind all of this, as you pointed out, is I think relative deprivation, which is well documented to say that even though, let's say if a person would earn 3,000 ringgit per month, right?
Mm-hmm.
They would feel much unhappier if they know that they are surrounded by people who earn 10,000 ringgit per month, right? Which is often, I think, the case in Selangor.
Mm-hmm.
Compared to a person who only earns like 1,500 ringgit, but everyone around earns around like a maximum 2,000 ringgit, you actually feel like your income is much more tolerable compared to even if you earn more. So even if you earn more, but you're surrounded by people who earn roughly the same, you wouldn't be happier or like less happy because of that, right?
Right.
So I think this concept, right, is most prevalent because of two things in Selangor. First is how places are structured, right?
Mm.
In a place of higher development like Selangor, you would constantly see buildings that are being built. They are higher and higher. You would see much better restaurants being opened across your neighborhood. And because of that rapid development, you would also have certain parts of the state that couldn't catch up, right? Mm-hmm. Where you would see a very rich place opposite just a slum area, right? Where it is still inadequate. And I think how it is structured has a lot to do, because once you walk outside of your house, you're constantly reminded about how poor you are relative to other people around you, right? Now, the second thing that was quite prevalent in Selangor is that this is also a state that receives a lot of migration from other states, right? People migrate to Selangor for economic opportunities, but people don't migrate to Kelantan for economic opportunities. So what that means is that your starting point was actually worse than what a general Selangor population has. That's why you need to go there to work, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when you go there to work, there's greater siege mentality, there's a greater feeling like you're being surrounded by things that are totally out of reach for you. And therefore, on a daily basis, you would feel unhappier compared to if you had just stayed in your home state. Even though you earn lesser, you would probably have lesser feelings of relative deprivation.
All right. Before we wrap this conversation up, James, this has been really, really fascinating. Would you have some final thoughts or a final message for us?
I do think that generally, it is important for the Malaysian population to be able to live a very dignified life, right? So while we keep talking about minimum wage, we already know for many years from publications like Bank Negara that a dignified wage is important, right?
Mm-hmm.
That the constant focus of government through their policies has to be to how do I make this population ultimately to a group of people who, like I said at the beginning, be able to freely decide how they want to structure their lives. And that means that you need to give them enough to be able to do that. Because if you look at a lot of developed countries, when income is really no longer a problem, people start to move to a point where they reduce their work hours and instead they use their additional time to pursue other creative interests that are probably closer to who they are and the purpose for why they live. So it is quite a coincidence that a lot of people who are rich enough, they would pursue creative outlets, right? Either through the arts or like through any other, or like, you know, making films and music and so on, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think this gives us some sort of reminder that we need to get to that destination where Malaysians can also enjoy some parts of that life Because if not, you only have like 70 plus years.
Yeah.
You don't want to waste it just slogging it out at a work that you don't like. So I think fundamentally, it is surprising that not enough government ministers are motivated by that. But we do know that that's the ideal state that we want to get to just based on what's happening in developed countries.
And on that note, thank you so much for joining me today, James.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was James Chai, visiting fellow at the ICS Yusof Ishak Institute. If you missed any part of the conversation, you can also check us out on podcasts. We're available on the BFM app, bfm.my, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. I'm Dashrin Johan, and this has been Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.